everything, that he had all the answers, that he had all of this knowledge. Point of fact, to Socrates, he was wise only because he would admit that he didn't know very much. Now, this produced something interesting and important, at least in our literary picture of Socrates, and that is his method of demonstrating that other people didn't know very much either. We call this the elenchus. It is Socrates' elaborate and cunning and trenchant way of questioning people until he had utterly befuddled them and demonstrated that in point of fact they didn't really know what they pretended to know. Now, it's not hard to see why a person like that was not especially popular with his contemporaries. Who among us would like to bump into somebody in the grocery store who came up and started asking us a lot of questions and left us a blithering mass of confusion? This would not make us happy. And indeed, Socrates did not make his contemporaries happy. But the point is, it raises the question, did he formulate a positive body of doctrine, or did he really poke holes in sort of what was out there? Well, most of what we know about Socrates, as I indicated, comes from his pupil, Plato. Plato also, born in 429 BC, in the second year of the Peloponnesian War, dying in 347 BC, the middle of the tumultuous 4th century. Plato was a consummate stylist. He's a beautiful, beautiful writer, an engaging writer. There is something seductive about reading Plato. He was a wide-ranging thinker. He was interested in an enormous array of problems. He came from a wealthy and influential family. He had traveled widely. He devoted most of his adult life to philosophy. Now, that's important. It's important to say he had the means to do so. He had the means to do so. He was able to lead a kind of a leisured life. In about 385, he founded his academy, his school. And hence, people who study are ever after academics. Plato could probably have had a distinguished public career in Athens. He probably could have held high public office and won the esteem of his fellow citizens in that way. It appears that he went off sort of to a private life of study because he was so disillusioned over the death, the execution indeed, at the hands of the Athenian institutions of his master Plato. And so, of his master Socrates, I'm sorry. And so, he tells us that he dedicated his life to defending his master's teachings. We'll see, as we go along here, what we ought to think about that proposition. Now, let's quickly review where philosophy had got itself to at the moment when the sophists were on the scene, when Socrates was on the scene, when Plato was becoming disillusioned and withdrawing from public life. Change appears to be a constant. Stability is elusive. Everything around us seems to be changing all the time. The senses are flawed. They are very flawed tools of perception. Language has severe limitations as a tool of communication. Laws are mere human contrivances and not eternal verities, eternal regulations. That's the past. That's where things stand. That's the problem that you've got to solve, or the series of problems. Now, all is not negative. All is not negative. Because we can also say, if all of that is the red ink in the ledger, we can put some black ink in that ledger too. The Greeks had demonstrated in a very sophisticated way, in a very sophisticated way indeed, that appearances could be deceiving. Now, this was not something which then caused them to fly off in anguish at their inability to know anything. Socrates wasn't anguished. Plato wasn't anguished, as we'll see. But they did understand, they had come to understand in a profound way, that world out there may not be as it seems. And therefore, we got some work to do to figure out how it actually works. Second, and even more important, through its elaboration of epistemology, through its elaboration of thinking about thinking, the Greeks built into the Western tradition an internal critique. The Western tradition is virtually unique in providing positive doctrine and a large technical methodology for qualifying, analyzing, questioning, exploring that doctrine. This is a remarkable achievement. This is a remarkable achievement to spawn doctrine and all the tools to test it and possibly to prove it wrong. This is quite remarkable. And that was there already by the time Socrates had come on the scene. So Plato wants to defend his master's teachings. In a sense, in doing this, he poses two big kinds of questions. What is the nature of knowledge, and what means do we have of obtaining it? All right, now we can see how that question is rooted in the experience of 5th century Athens. Second, what is morality in the best form of human life? How should we live? So there is a very powerful practical dimension to Plato's thinking. Plato was a prolific writer. That's one of the interesting and challenging things about him. You go stand before all of Plato's books and they make a pretty long shelf. That's a lot of writing to get to grips with. His earliest works were in dialogue form, possibly because this accorded with Socratic teaching. It may have been that he used the dialogue because that's the way his master had taught, and if he wants to defend and to advance his master's teaching, he'll do it sort of in